Welcome to the conversation that every woman should be having. I'm Maya Fisher-French, and my co-host and inspiration for this podcast is Andrea Carr. Now, these conversations should really be relevant to anyone in a relationship, especially when there are children involved and you have that extra workload of caregiving. In these conversations, we're trying to understand how to navigate this space so that it feels fair from a financial, physical, and emotional perspective. Now, in our previous discussions, we've spoken to a prominent lawyer about marriage contracts. We've spoken to a financial planner about creating financial independence. And we also spoke to a wills expert about protecting our families if something happens to us. So we've covered a lot of the practical stuff, maybe the stuff we feel a little bit more comfortable with. But now we're going to enter the uncomfortable. We're going to be speaking to Connie Volkan, who is a relationship therapist, about having these money conversations. And what does it mean when you can't talk about money? So Andrea, in your experience, do you think it is challenging to talk about money in a relationship?
It is. In my experience, over the last 14 or 15 years, it is a type of conversation I've avoided. I avoid conflict generally, and I associate these kinds of difficult money-related conversations to be difficult conflict-driven ones. I do acknowledge, though, that I have been financially comfortable for the last 15 years in a relationship, and therefore I haven't needed to have, or I haven't had a pressing urge or need to talk about money. And it was only in a recent conversation with a friend where I wanted to talk about her financial situation. She took herself out of the job market for 10 years to raise her children, and her husband decided that they could do this and they could live with two children on one salary. And as a result, they had to make some very, very difficult decisions around how to manage their finances. And in doing so, they had all of the difficult conversations I think I'd avoided. Their situation necessitated it. If they wanted to survive a period of tough financial challenges like they did face for 10 years, they needed to be very, very conscious and have intentional discussions around how they spent money as a family and in their household. So I realized my situation might not be unique, and it is sometimes just easy to avoid general difficult conversations about money if you don't have to have them.
So therefore, to help us navigate the emotional part of money and relationships, we're joined by a relationship therapist, Connie Volkan. And Connie, you told me that in your many years of experience, there are three main issues that cause trouble in relationships: money, sex, and in-laws. I do think that sex and in-laws is a podcast waiting to happen, but for today, we're going to focus on the money issue. Connie, why is money such an emotional issue?
Money means so many different things. It's so central. Money sometimes is a core issue in the power balance in a relationship. But money also implies success. Money can imply caring. Money is connected with status. For some people, money is hugely about safety. And for some, money and gifts are connected to the language of love. So it's a huge issue, and it's different for everyone. It's loaded as anything. In fact, in talking about this after we spoke, it is so emotive that when I speak to people, they slip straight into anecdotes. I said, you know, I'm doing a podcast about woman and money and marriage. Oh my God, let me tell you this, let me tell you that. Everybody is into the anecdote. So they slip into emotion. Don't stay in rationality. Huge issue.
I love that. Money is not about money. It's about emotions. It reflects everything. And I just on a little bit of a side note, I was mentioning to you before, you know, I know someone who takes people out of her will whenever she's having an argument with them. And I mean, people see those sorts of things. It's like, if I leave money to someone, it's because I love them. Therefore, if I cross with them, I won't leave them money. So there's this whole love-giving thing that goes on behind money. And it's actually quite scary.
That's the way I can exert my power.
Ah, It's also about power. It's about power. It's about emotions, feelings, love. Very, very complicated. And Connie, you know, again, you and you and I are chatting beforehand. You said to me, one of the problems is when you enter in a marriage is we enter into default roles. And those default roles may be, you know, things that we were raised with, but we never actually have that discussion. And I think, Andrew, you identified that as exactly what happened to you. So just maybe give us an idea of what you think drove the roles that you landed up.
So I was raised by a stay-at-home mom on a farm in a small community. And I never questioned the fact that my mum was always going to be there. She was going to physically provide meals, clothes. She took us to boarding school. She was that kind, caring, loving person in my life from the first moment I can recall any memory. And I knew growing up that I wanted to be like my mum. But I also knew a little bit more about myself and knew that I wasn't going to be a stay-at-home mom forever. I needed a career. That was important to me. Look what I knew at 18 versus what I know now. Probably not that different. But my upbringing has made me who I am today. And I was certainly driven by the need to be an amazing mom like my own was to me when it came to falling into that default role of being an amazing mom to my children, but with the added burden of having a full-time career. And I never anticipated what kind of juggle that would be for me on a daily basis, just to be everything to everyone all the time.
And Cody, I mean, for you, do you think that that is what generally happens? Well, the man goes and works and is the provider, you, the woman, so you look after the kids without ever really discussing this stuff.
I think it's very important to picture your journey. I think it really is because you can't assume things. I would say to young women, have a look at the gender roles in his family. Have a look at the marriage relationship in his family. If there are red flags, discuss it. But you can't assume the picture. And it's a good thing to discuss. You know, how do you fall in love? Is it all about sexual attraction? Is it all about shared interests in the moment? Or do you look at the journey you picture? And some men are very adamant that they want their children very carefully raised. Others don't want the financial burden of looking after a woman. So, you know, what can one assume?
It's so interesting you say that because I, maybe we'll get into another discussion, but I know a man who he wasn't married yet, but he said, my wife will always work. I'm not interested in someone who thinks she can stay at home. There was this perception of, that was really strong for him. I mean, these are discussions and you need to understand, and I'm not sure what was behind that psychologically, but you know, these are, everyone's going to come into that marriage with some kind of perception and whoever discusses that up front.
Also an important point is, do you want to share raising children? Because, you know, men of this generation are one hang of a lot better than they were in my day. And men often do want to. And when they do want to, then they value what you're doing more because they know you're not just sitting drinking coffee. They run back to work and say, thank God for her. So that is an issue as well.
I think that is, and it definitely has changed. My mom keeps saying, she says, oh, you're so lucky. Is it my day? A man would never change an apple.
Yes.
It is improving. But do you think that, I mean, and certainly, I would say every generation, these balances are improving. And even if you look at countries, the Scandinavian countries, certainly in the Netherlands, there's a lot more equality around parenting. But what's interesting, I might tell you, that I was reading some statistics around this, that even though women have become, in those countries, there's a lot more equality around parenting, women still look after the elderly, not the men. That is still something that men don't do. So I think, you know, we still largely have this caregiving nature. It's often our biology, it's often our default position. Do you think, to some extent, we've shot ourselves in the foot? You know, we've demanded a seat at the table. We want to have the career. We want to have the financial independence. But we haven't really navigated or had enough conversations about being overburdened by it all.
You know, you talk about conversations as though let's have conversations. Conversations are very complex in marriages. There's an art to having a conversation in a marriage.
And this is probably why we avoid them a lot of the time, because we don't all have that art.
Yeah. Not all conversations are as delicious, you know. the dentist versus the best eatery. So conversations are not a given. And a woman as carers, I can say a lot about that. I don't know if you want me to.
Go ahead.
Well, there's a very interesting thought, but it comes from another angle, Maya, so you may not want to hear it. But in all the theories about gender-based violence, which is huge at the moment, it's the number one issue in our country. Femicide is like crazy, once every 6 hours. But one of the interesting outputs is that we have to raise boys differently. And in raising boys differently, one of the things is that boys need to be raised so that their masculinity doesn't depend on toughness, and that they could be caregivers. And they can be emotional, and they can need to talk. And big boys don't cry went out with the 50s. But that's a digression.
I'm raising two boys. So I know, and I've got to raise two boys in a very, very changing world. And it's challenging because the roles are changing.
Yeah. But younger men, I think, are equipped to be better carers because they've been raised perhaps in a more child-focused era. And I think sharing caretaking of children civilizes a marriage a lot.
Yeah. And when the marriage does dissolve and you start to share custody of children, as I will be doing going forward, I think it's good for my children to see that the roles that have traditionally been filled by the two different parties in their family unit at the time are now going to be filled in a slightly different way. Dad can cook. He knows how. I did it out of necessity. But that doesn't mean that Dad can't and won't. And he will certainly be doing more of that. And the kids are going to see a lot more of a lot more balanced households going forward, because those roles are and will continue to evolve in my family unit.
I think that is. And I think bringing in allowing the men to be more involved is also, you know, we can probably discuss about our protected areas, right? perhaps how we deal with it. But I want to talk a little bit now about what we find as what we talk about equity in a relationship. So if I look now, things change and evolve. So when we went for marriage counseling when I was pregnant, I said to my husband, I want to have a conversation about how this is all going to work. And one of the most important things that I had, and in fact, Connie knows the person I went to, Darren, I wanted him to know that he couldn't play golf every Saturday, you know, that things were going to change. But after a period of time, I initially thought I'd be at home for a while. And within 6 months, I realized I wasn't cut out for it. And interestingly, there were two reasons. One, I mentally wanted to get back to work. I found being a mom, to be perfectly honest, really boring. And the other was financial. And my husband and I have always been, there's never been a money issue we've always had good be able to have talk about money. But I remember two things. One was I felt guilty having a facial, because I felt like it was his money, even though he never made me feel like that. I had that perception. And the other, I remember, he cancelled the subscription to the Business Day newspaper for our home, because he got one at work. And I said, but I read the Business Day. And it was almost like, well, you're not working now, so you don't need to keep up with things. And I remember these things really bothered me. So how do you understand also now, I go back to work now because I choose to as well, but now I'm still the main caregiver and I'm working. And how does this equality,
I think that equity, the way that the vista that I think is helpful is that you want a marriage with equity, but it's not going to be 50-50 in each division. And there are many divisions. There's caretaking of children. There's keeping social relationships with friends. There's tidying the house. There's planning holidays. There's money. There's, you know, who looks after reaching out to family. Because, you know, you enter, each of you have got your sort of own personal music. And now you're going to make joint music. So there are many divisions, and not all of them will be 50-50. And I think the default that women get into is that money is his division. And a very important point is that a woman has to take financial responsibility from the get-go. He can manage it, but she has to take financial responsibility. Where are things? I need to know. You could drop dead. It doesn't always have to be combative. You know, if you find a girlfriend, what will happen to me? That's not a great conversation starter. But if you drop dead, how do I look after the children? If you got injured, I want to know, because I want you to share with me the decisions you make. And, you know, men have got ways of avoiding this. Don't worry, you'll just call my accountant, Joe. No, I want to meet Joe.
And it's also never too late to have that first conversation. Women might think, well, I haven't ever asked about the finances. We've been married for 20 years. 20 years in one day is the time to have that conversation. It's obviously too late if someone gets hit by a bus, but just because you haven't talked about those things in the past doesn't mean, for anyone watching today, doesn't mean you can't ask tomorrow.
Absolutely. And there are ways to go into it. There are ways. I'm curious. I feel about our health. I'm concerned about the children.
I watched this amazing video, or I listened to this incredible podcast, and it made me think about things.
It's a good way. Here's the link.
And then, of course, the rebuttal. Don't you trust me? What's going on here? Well, you have to get past that. I do trust you, and I want you to trust me. That's why I want to know. And, you know, it's an important area. Also, it's not combative things, because women need to know, what can I purchase without causing a war? What is okay? What is discretionary for me? What if I want to buy you a fabulous gift and I don't want you to know that there's been a withdrawal? You know, so there are many ways to get into it.
That raises a question in my mind around financial independence and how that looks completely different for everyone. I told a story earlier about my mum who raised chickens and sold eggs, and that gave her the financial independence that she needed. That was important for her. And it would have meant something completely different to any one of her friends. And even in my era, financial independence now versus 5 years ago, those are two very, very different pictures in my head. It's a little bit more of a scary picture for me now, because financial independence is just me alone, and there are some steps I know I need to take in order to get to that point. But financial independence is important for women, and if you don't earn money and you are full-time stay-at-home mom and carer to your children, it doesn't mean that you should be foregoing financial independence, and you need to have some conversations around what that looks like and what your household needs to do to make that happen.
Well, an important point, and women should hear this, is that money is good for women. And I think where women are entrepreneurial, they know it. But property is very good for women. And women should not be in a position, those who are, you know, not everyone can afford things like owning property. But if you can, do not let the family home be in his name. In other parts of the world, it's 50-50, any property, doesn't matter whose name it's in. So that's a weakness in South Africa. So property is very important. And in your point, there's lots of good advice. Carry your own plastic in your name. Have a discussion, what's yours, mine, and ours. And also, for women who stop work, it's very important, especially if they do it temporarily, to keep skin in the game. Keep your professional registration, keep your group of colleagues. Work sometimes, help out where you can. If you were a teacher, you'll do a locum. And also, a community of women is a very important thing. From an earlier stage, that community of women is a game changer. I've heard mommies from the earliest times talk about how the antenatal group saved their lives in all sorts of ways. It starts out with sleepless nights, the dummy, what happens to your sex life when there's a baby. But that community of women is something that is inestimable in the adult life of a woman. It may change, might not be the antenatal group. You referred a lot to your community of friends, but these things should be discussed there because it's like a crucible of testing out.
I wouldn't survive without my support groups, and there are multiple of them. I'm just going to apologize because the conversation has changed somewhat, and I think it's for the better. I mentioned earlier how I've known a group of women for 20 years, and we all got married together, and we all had children together, and we talked about flowers and honeymoon and babies and baby names and nothing around long-term decisions. So to all of my support groups out there, the conversations have already started to change, and we're now having these discussions, and I'm learning so much from similarly placed women who have all got professional careers. They are all working moms like me, and what I've learned from them is it's huge for me.
And I think what's really important as well is that I've had conversations with friends who They almost say to me, their husband has made these choices and decisions and they're just going with it. And I mean, I remember one friend saying, no, her husband says he's not taking out life cover because he doesn't want anyone to be enriched on his death. And I'm like, wait, let's just breathe. I had to breathe for like 5 minutes before I could answer that. But just in being able to say to her, has he thought about actually what your lives are going to look like if something happens to him? So it's very important because she kind of says, well, that's just the way it is. So often in those conversations, you can help empower women. And I hope the women listening here are also going to use this opportunity to empower and to start these conversations. But I wanted, Connie, to ask you this question. We've talking a lot about, obviously, somebody who's now in a marriage coming, in particular in Andrew's case, marriage coming to an end. But what about someone getting married? Because I think if you can lay the groundwork up front, what are the conversations they should be having about this equity in marriage? And if you can't have this conversation up front, is this a red flag? Is this, I better walk away?
It could be a red flag, but marriage doesn't happen in one crack. Legal marriage might happen at the ceremony, but the sexual marriage might have begun a year before. And the emotional marriage may grow. The parent part will come when they're children. And the financial marriage may take a while. A prenup is a good place to move into the financial parts of it. But a financial marriage may take time. And others, you know, in the era of arranged marriages, the emotional connections come afterwards. So it doesn't always happen in one go. And I think with Andrea, actually, what didn't happen was the financial marriage.
I think that is such a powerful point. I don't think we ever think about it like that. But you're coming together emotionally. You're coming together legally. But have you come together financially?
And I must tell you, I know a financial planner whose client, he brought his daughter, before she got married, he said, you have to go and see my financial planner. So go and see a financial planner, see a lawyer, make sure you understand your financial position when you enter.
Yep. So in other words, proxies are a subtle help, because it's hard for young people to hit this head on.
In fact, you make me, I do sometimes talks and things like that for women's groups, and I often get this response. I've tried to talk to my husband doesn't want to talk about this. And I say, go home now and say, I've just been at this amazing workshop. I didn't know this, this, and this. Could you explain it to me? Like, do we have a will? Or, like, go in with this interested, like, please explain it to me. Use that workshop as the opening to have those conversations.
Also, there are things like, what is your style with money? Because, you know, there are people who love to budget and people who think it's the most boring thing. There are people who spend a lot and people who are forever conserving. You know, what if that happens? But, you know, it's a very important thing is what must we do when we disagree? And that's not just about money. What must we do when we disagree about the kids? What must we do when we disagree about people we want to be with? And that's really, you know, one of the things that's an issue in the early part of marriage is who decides what about which issues? Who controls the decisions about when we see the in-laws, how we spend our money, when we have sex? What we'll do about the kids, where we'll travel. And it's often a bun fight.
So I think there's the marriage counselling side of it, of how do we have these conversations. And there's also the financial side about how do we want to set this up. And I was actually, one of the things that I found that I do quite a lot with workshops I do, is there's a couple questionnaire I get them to do around money. And it's about their upbringing around money. And it is one of the most eye-opening things, because often you're stuck in this position about you're boxing over something. And then when you understand how they were raised and their money messages and their feelings and emotions around money, you're able to come in with a lot more of a compassionate perspective. One woman I was dealing with recently, her husband's taken on a whole lot of debt because he keeps lending money to family and to friends and all this. And when they did the money questionnaire, she realized he'd come from a poorer background than she had, and he had this belief and feeling that he had to give and show, and so she was able to start addressing it from a compassion perspective. And she came from a position, her money feelings were fear, that if I can't provide for myself, I can't. So when you can start talking about your emotions and what's driving them, I think that could also be for marriage counseling or starting to get married, having those money, like what does money mean to you, and what was your upbringing?
Yeah, I think you have to assume the good intent of your partner. That's the way to do it. There is some methodology that is helpful. The one is to assume good intent. The other is not to use the blaming vocabulary. You know, you didn't this and you're not that. And you say, I am concerned. I have sleepless nights if you drop dead. I want to know. I care. I care what worries you.
You know what's coming up for me quite a lot recently? A woman contacting me who are married with children. They're worried that if something happens to them, the husband will not look after the children financially. That he'll remarry. There'll be other kids. That's a big fear as well. And of course, we've spoken to Moramadi, our wills expert, but that's one of the things that one has to also, you can have all these conversations, but if you have a fear, you can also address it by doing things like having a will that protects your child's money and things like that. But
yes, a will is a chance to name guardians, to look at this issue, yes.
Maybe actually, Connie, to sum up, and is that
what we actually is at essence, and probably over the last four episodes has been at the essence, is that we do not value caregiving in any form in society. Teachers are paid worse. Nurses are paid worse. Anyone who plays a caregiving role, it is not understood the impact that that has on society. And I think actually it's a society issue.
Well, what an interesting point. You know, I read a wonderful article, I think it was in Time magazine, where they deconstructed families with superbly successful children. And they looked at what were some common parameters. I mean, it was quite extraordinary, but the one that I remember is that I think that was about five different families. The mothers were all involved in education.
So they were teachers or lecturers or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's, so, I mean, that's like a magic bullet.
That's it. If you want your children to be successful, be a teacher and be yourself.
And yeah, but I think in the modern world, men know that they need smart, amazing, integrated women if they want their kids to fly.
And on that note, thank you, Connie, and Andrea. I think it's been a really interesting conversation. Again, we're unpacking this. We're trying to understand. We're trying to navigate spaces that empowers all of us to have better relationships with our partners, with our money, with our children. So please give us your feedback. Give us topics you would like us to be discussing so that we can keep this conversation going and help you to have those conversations yourself at home. So thank you.